I'm somebody who finds graffiti very eye-catching. I saw this recently, inked up on a wall. If you feel strongly about graffiti, sign a partition. Well, how about this one, signed by John Paul Getty? The meek will inherit the earth, but not the mineral rights, signed John Paul Getty. But this morning, we're thinking about the most famous bit of graffiti ever, which was written by God. It was God who put the writing on the wall. Indeed, the chapter we're looking at this morning is the incident which has given us the phrase, the somber phrase and line, "The writing is on the wall." The background: well, Nebuchadnezzar had died in 562 BC, and the Babylonian Empire began to deteriorate, and kings came and went. And this chapter we're looking at this morning is a spectacular chapter. It starts slowly, but it gathers speed. There's feasting and festivity. Look at chapter 5, verse 1, will you? King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. There's feasting and festivity. 1,000 lords and ladies living it up together. Oh yes, the chapter is ponderous and repetitive in the opening verses, but then there's a rapid acceleration at the end when Babylon is overrun and destroyed by the Persian Darius the Mede. And Belshazzar's name, literally Bel protect the king, one of the Babylonian deities his name comes from, well, he's shown to be full of empty pretense. One of the things we're invited to do in Daniel is to compare Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, who we were looking at last time in chapter 4. But this is a very horrible and somber chapter. If Nebuchadnezzar, at the end, is a bright jewel, well, this morning we've got the black velvet, the bad news, in comparison. So a feast to remember, a spectacular banquet, but the end is so very sad. Will you notice, please, first of all, Belshazzar, a man who tried to forget. As is clear from verse 30, the armies of Cyrus are already closing in. But Belshazzar decides to party. Perhaps he organized it to negate the risk of a preemptive coup in the court. Or perhaps it was plain escapism. Perhaps he just wanted to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we might die. Certainly it was full of uncontrolled hedonism. 5 times in the first 4 verses, drinking is mentioned. Now, yes, the Bible says that wine is given to gladden the heart of men. But the picture here is a picture of extreme dissolution. Look at verse 2, will you? While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't actually his father, but was his predecessor in power, and therefore, in that Near Eastern sense, he was his father. But there's lots of alcohol. They were intoxicated with booze. And Belshazzar, in a drunken stupor, is blasphemous in his behavior and actions. Well, we know from Ezra 1, verse 9, but all the things have been taken from the temple. In fact, what had been brought to Babylon consisted of 5,400 goblets and basins of silver and gold, a vast number of things taken from the temple. And there's Belshazzar thinking that God can be mocked with impunity. His actions imply he thought that Yahweh had no power in Babylon. So he goes on with his blasphemous behavior and actions. And we too can make the same mistake. We can be blasphemous when we're careless about Christian things. Perhaps when we ignore the claims or the words of Jesus Christ or the Bible's teaching. I'm deeply shocked by that bishop who said the last few weeks that he's given up reading the Bible for Lent and is reading the Quran instead. Well, how about mistreating folk made in God's image? Well, that's actually blasphemous in our behaviour and actions. But there's not just a drunkenness, there's also uncontrolled sensuality. Look, will you, at verses 3 and 4. They brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Belshazzar was drunk with his wives and prostitutes, and it was a scandalous breach of normal protocol to invite the harem to a party where your wife or wives were. A picture of wine, women, and song. It was a reckless orgy of self-indulgence and hedonism, a deliberate act of sacrilege. Imagine Belshazzar standing there and saying, I'm going to propose a toast. I propose we sing to the God of gold. So they pour wine into the sacred vessels in the temple, and they drink to the God of gold. Then they sing to the God of gold. When they're through drinking and singing to the God of gold, then the king proposes that they sing to the God of silver. And they pour wine again into the goblets, and they sing to the God of silver. They repeat the same, and they sing to the gods of bronze and wood and stone. Blasphemous. Then look at verses 5 and 6. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of a wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. A nervous collapse, a total collapse for Belshazzar. And verse 7, the wise men of Babylon are wheeled in, but the science of Babylon is impotent. They couldn't even decipher, let alone interpret, or perhaps the text implies they couldn't read it because they couldn't see it. Certainly the implication of verse 9 is that the king was terrified and all the others are baffled. They couldn't see why the king was terrified. Perhaps it's rather like Banquo's ghost in Macbeth. Then verse 10, the queen mother appears, Nebuchadnezzar's wife probably, and tells Belshazzar about the now elderly Daniel. You see, Daniel had been discarded and pensioned off for his monotheistic nonconformity during the pagan Renaissance. But now he's recalled. And in verses 10 to 16, Belshazzar begs for help from one of the very people whose God he's been insulting just minutes before. And that's very up to date, isn't it? I was speaking with a number of teenagers this last week when I was doing some Lent addresses in a school. And one of the sixth formers said to me, of course, belief is just escapism. And I try to argue against that. But I know from experience that very often, when there's real trouble on the doorstep, it is the unbeliever who turns to escape. And it's the believer who has something to say to him. Here's Belshazzar, a man who tried to forget military and political and theological realities. But then second, Belshazzar's a man who refused to learn. Look at verses 22 and 23, will you? Here's Daniel speaking. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you. And you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. As we said just now, it was a terrible thing to have done. Oh yes, Belshazzar knew about Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Well, Nebuchadnezzar had issued an encyclical. Look back to chapter 4 sometime. It was on the court records, not just a myth in the Jewish community. No, it's been recorded in the history of Babylon, what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar, all spoken of in those earlier verses. But then look on to verses 25 to 28. because here's Daniel interpreting and explaining the inscription. Mene, mene, tekel, parsin. This is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Now, scholars are puzzled over the words in this vision. Mene, tekel, and parsin. But they are each words which are the names of small weights, such as will be used in the marketplace. And the underlying thought is that there's going to be an assessment in the balances of divine justice. And Daniel uses the proverbial style of a Middle Eastern sage. So there's a pun round each word. An Aramaic noun is linked to a similar Aramaic verb. Interestingly enough, this part of Daniel is written Aramaic. Why? Well, because it could speak into the situation of the Persians later on, because they understood that language. It's not all written in Hebrew, this book. Mene, mene, tekel, parsin. The royal plaster wall in the palace resembles a gravestone, and an epitaph is written upon it. Verse 26, your days are numbered. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. That is, your credit limit has been reached. It was Hector Berlioz, the French composer, who said this, time is a great teacher, but unfortunately it kills all its pupils. Yes, you see, our days are numbered. Our opportunities are numbered. Our lives are numbered. We might say that time is the only one of God's gifts which is constantly decreasing. It is a shock when you realize your days are numbered. I have a sibling who's not a Christian. She lives in Los Angeles. And one day she's in a bank, and the bank was robbed. Not only did they fire at her with a gun as they left the bank, they also then took a car. That made her think quite a lot that day. And then she missed a helicopter flight because of that, and the helicopter crashed with all her colleagues on board. It really scared her. She even rang me up to ask me what I thought about it. We need to recall verse 26, that our days are numbered. There's no way of escaping this ultimate reality. As C.S. Lewis has said, the future is something which everyone reaches at a rate of 60 minutes an hour, whatever he does, whoever he or she is. Your days are numbered. Then verse 27, you've been weighed. You've been weighed on the scales and found wanting, and found short of godliness and goodness. That's what God says to Belshazzar. You see, the fact of judgment needs to be taken into account. The eternal judge will weigh us and give a verdict. And we need to glory in that, because otherwise life is meaningless. We've been warned. God sees us just as we are. And God's scales are absolutely fair and utterly precise. Well, perhaps you protest, I'm not like Belshazzar, you say. Well, actually we are. Our attitudes, our words, our actions, our thoughts are all weighed. We've been weighed, and we've all been weighed light in comparison to God's true standard for human life, revealed in the Bible and supremely in the life and character of Jesus Christ. Your days are numbered, you've been weighed. Verse 28, your kingdom is divided. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. It's very stark. God says, I am your appointed executioner. I've appointed your executioner and will remove you and your kingdom. And yet, Belshazzar goes on and seems to ignore reality in verse 29. And just clothes Daniel in purple and proclaims him the third highest ruler in the kingdom. What happened? Well, look at verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Babylon was taken over by coalition forces. I've been to Babylon in modern-day Iraq. I've wandered around that site and explored it for a whole day. And it's fascinating what happened when Babylon was taken over. Herodotus tells us what occurred. Cyrus divided his army into three groups. One group gathered in the north, where the Euphrates enters the city. I've been to look at that area. A second group gathered in the south, where the river left the city. I've been to look at that as well. And a third group marched upstream, where they diverted the river into a swamp, making it possible to ford the river downstream at the city. And so what happened? Well, the Persian army waded across the river and entered without a fight. The unimaginable occurred. Nobody would ever guess that would have happened to Babylon, but it happened that very night. Your days are numbered, you've been weighed, your kingdom is divided. You see, Belshazzar tried to forget and refused to learn, and his kingdom toppled. But let me conclude. This chapter is a comfort to the believer and a great discomfort to you if you're an unbeliever. It comforts the believer because it reminds us that God is sovereign, that God rules over history. They're in exile, and yet Yahweh was in control still. But think about the church at the end of the 20th century. It's rather like the Jews in exile. We feel like we're a lone voice where we work, in a hospital, or in a university, in our office, or even perhaps in our families. And it may seem that secularism and hedonism is calling all the shouts. But it's God who will have the last word. A comfort to the believer. But then discomfort to the unbeliever. Because although we live in an age of change, there is such a thing as irreversible change. Opportunity does come to an end. It was Robert Louis Stevenson who said this: everyone sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences. Ah, yes, Belshazzar's feast banquet had started well. He could never have guessed what was going to happen that night. However mighty we are, we will all give an account one day. I wonder if you know Gray's Elegy. The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty and all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. You see, God's judgment may seem slow, but it is thorough and is most certainly coming. And if we continue to ignore God and spurn him, the day of judgment will mean for us hell and not heaven. But if we return to God in and through Jesus Christ, it will not be an accusing hand, but a welcoming hand, the hand of the crucified Christ, which will welcome us into his presence. You see, on the day of judgment, we can actually shelter in the salvation Jesus offers. We remember in a few moments this morning a cross as we take the emblems of bread and wine. But remember, it's now an empty cross. And Jesus is risen and glorified. He's the King of Kings. What does it mean for us? Well, forgiveness of the past and hope for the future. But we actually can become members of a kingdom which will never topple.